gaggle of geese. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us. I'm Angelo Viola. He is Peter Bowman. This is Outdoor Journal Radio podcast. Behind the scenes, Vova, Nick, and Dean are... Dean is also the producer of the show, and Dean is also our research department, and Dean is also...
He's pretty much everything we do.
Oh, my.
What's Nick? If Dean's everything we do, what's Nick?
Oh, God. That's a great question.
Absent.
Absent?
As usual.
Right now? thanks for joining us once again. You know, we don't tell you often enough how much we love you, but we do love you. We love you because without you, I don't know where I'd be, a delinquent somewhere right now.
I think you might still have some of them tendencies in you.
Yeah, I think so.
Once the camera stops rolling.
Sometimes I can be nasty.
But these good folks keep me under control. Thank you, folks, for that.
And that's why we appreciate
it. I hate to see him
you.
Without this. He would be out of... Oh, my God. Thank you, people.
Wonderful program today. Speaking about out of control, our main subject, and our guest will be talking to it, the subject later on in the program. His name is Dr. Steve Cote, and they're doing an interesting study. I think it might be the first of its kind, certainly in this country, regarding I think anybody who spends any amount of time in the outdoors during the winter period, we've all seen that sickly looking moose standing on the edge of the highway, and you look at him. Sometimes we'll stop and take pictures. You say, my God, what is the matter with that animal? Like, it's lost most of its fur, hair, and you can tell that it's very weak.
Looks feral. It's a zombie or something, right? Yeah.
And for the most part, that is the net result of something called a winter tick.
Friggin' ticks, man. They're just not good, are they?
Ticks are like, we're not talking the deer tick now. We're not talking the black-legged tick, which is the deer tick, which is a vector for Lyme disease. This is a different animal called a winter tick. And its job is to reproduce. That's all it does. It comes into the environment.
Something like yourself.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I like that.
How's that working out for you lately?
The Countess might have something to say about that. It's an interesting relationship, if you will, a reluctant relationship between moose and winter tick, because they're directly connected. Without one, there isn't the other. And so we'll find out about this later on in the program.
It's interesting. I didn't even know that existed. You know what I mean? I had no idea there was such a thing as a winter tick. We always hear about black-legged, but cool.
It's there's many things around us that we're not aware of, my
friend. You got that right.
And sometimes we're better off for not being aware of them.
Yeah, you're right. What you don't know don't hurt you.
That's right.
Right.
One thing that we'd like to make you aware of is the new season of the Fish in Canada show. If you haven't already started watching it, not a problem. It's not a big deal, but you might want to, if you're watching it on television, you might want to punch in that PVR and get it recorded for yourself, or watch it live every Saturday morning, 8 a.m., coast to coast on Global, except on the left coast. Those folks get to sleep in and watch it at 10:30.
Give me a hell yeah.
That's where you should be.
Yeah.
Also on Sportsman's Channel and WFN for you folks south of the border. We're on four times a week, I believe, on the World Fishing Network. So wherever you can get that, check us out if you haven't already done so. Mm-hmm. Season 38, by the way, that's the significance of the 38.
Wow. Right there. Really?
I got to do this for two more years and then boom.
Oh,
that's the magic number.
Big
4-0. No,
shutting
her
down.
I'm just saying that if I'm looking at that number there, if that was 40, I would think, well, that's very successful. It's a nice even number.
38 is pretty good. You're just looking for an even number, you know, 38. I always wonder
you're
what this even number is.
You need to retire
stuff.
Now.
No, just say, it's just a number. Are we going to stop her at 27? You know what I mean? What the hell?
No, you can't stop at an odd number. Why what not? The hell is.
Why not?
You can't.
I always choose odd numbers that way. No. I'm done with that even number stuff. That's too typical, I should say. Just too easy to do.
It's got to be even. It's got to be 40 or 50 or 60 or something.
What's
like
Ronnie
that?
Munn's number?
69. Oh, I see you fashion yourself after Ronnie.
No. Ronnie might be the guy you don't want to fashion yourself after. I just thought of that with an odd number. That's all.
There are a lot of numbers at the Fishing Canada store that you can hook up with.
Speaking of, that's good. Good segue, buddy. Nice.
Shop.fishingcanada.com.
You look good in that number you got on right now. For those that are watching us on YouTube.
Snappy little number.
Yes, sir. Yes,
and
sir.
You have the smaller version.
I got the smaller version.
You get the smaller version of this handsome, attractive brand. It, by the way, as I'm rubbing myself, I'm feeling the 12,000 individual stitches that it took to embroider this beautiful logo.
How many?
12,000 individual stitches.
What about this little guy?
I'm not sure, but I'll find out for you. That's that looks like about 2,000 or 3,000. But
holy
12,000 stitches went into this wonderful.
A lot of stitching.
Fish in Canada logo.
You gonna stop touching yourself soon?
No, I kind of like it actually.
That logo isn't on your nipple. You keep touching your nipple. Damn it! What the hell's going on here? This show is gone for a shit.
You too can have one of these. Moments that I'm having right now. If you have your own Fishing Canada hoodie, all available on shop.fishingcanada.com.
If they're listening on a podcast, they might buy it. But if I just watched you do that, I don't know if they're going to be buying that anymore. That's hilarious.
Listener feedback, Mr. Bowman. What do we got?
Listener feedback from Mr. Dave Hendrick from Instagram. See, we're getting them from all over the place. Awesome. Instagram, Facebook, email, et cetera, et cetera. YouTube. This is fantastic. So in response to our conversation with Paul J. Radomski, the walleye guy.
Walleye guy.
Question from Dave.
He was the one that our good buddy Teddy took objection to, right?
Well, I got to question this guy a little bit. So Dave Hendrick from Instagram says, to have a better fishery, has anyone ever questioned stocking bait fish? Certain minnows, shiners, et cetera, et cetera. More bait would maybe stop cannibalism, as in the walleye were eating the baby walleyes, and that's what he's worried about, walleyes?
Walleyes? I think that's correct. Maybe not. Maybe walleye would be plural as well as singular.
Yeah. But
can we look into that? Can somebody?
I'll look into it, yeah.
All right.
Okay. So Ange and I have definitely talked about this throughout our entire existence of in the world of fishing as stocking programs go on. Maybe we should be stocking bait fish too. And we've brought that up to many authorities, and we usually get the same answer, right? Which is?
Not a good idea. And now we know of certain cases where they do that. We've witnessed Hasty Lake would be one that comes to mind.
That's what came to my mind right off the hop. Because it's funny that you say that.
They have to. They have no choice because that lake is full of giant bass, both largemouth and smallmouth.
And lake trout.
But I have a feeling that the bass are kind of dominating that little speck of water.
So they introduce rainbow smelt into that Hasty Lake. And there is a Cisco base in there. They must survive on their own because I think Ray was telling us they don't restock Cisco, but yet there's lots in there, but they do the rainbow smelt. So maybe the smelt can't reproduce in there. I don't know what goes on in that lake, but they do that for the lake trout. And then of course the smallmouth and largemouth are all taking advantage of it. It makes sense.
But in reality, what's happening in a lot of jurisdictions is that they're taking the other approach to it. If the food base is starting to decline, then they look at it from the top down. They say, well, then we need to, if they're stocking, for example, the main predator in that lake, they will shorten the stocking numbers and try and balance it out that way.
Right.
I've always been of the opinion, like this gentleman, what's his name?
Dave.
I've been of his opinion. You know what? If the cupboards are drying up, the food is getting low, put more food in. It's a no-brainer. The reason they don't is because it's all about control. Good fishery management is nothing more than controlling Mother Nature, right? Because good fishery management means that that we as humans are controlling the numbers, and we're using this control in order to keep the populations healthy. In the case of bait and stocking bait fish in a lake, apparently it's not quite as easy. So the control issue is a little different.
Screwing with the ecosystem of the lake too, right? Let's just say, let's go back to Hasty, or any lake. If they said, okay, let's double up the amount of cisco that we put in this lake instead of the rainbow smelt, and then the cisco started to eat more insects and zooplankton and everything else, where they're just screwing up that whole ecosystem so that maybe eventually nothing else, the rainbow smelt and the minnows there, can't survive because there's no food for them. You know what I mean? I'm just throwing this out there. And then all of a sudden now it's just cisco, and the smallmouth, in this case we'll call smallmouth, only have to go out for cisco. They can't get any minnows anywhere, so they'll go and try and get a crayfish. Maybe it screwed them up so bad in that minnow department, let's just say, the regular shiners or mud minnows or whatever they have in there, it might just wipe them out completely by putting a different bait fish in. I don't know.
If you talk to a true scientist, he or she will tell you that anytime you screw around with nature, you run, you know, it's a slippery slope. You might increase the value of something and decrease the value of something
else. Catch a pike in one lake and drop it into a lake that doesn't have pike in it, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Think about it that way.
To me, you know,
I think what Dave's saying is this, that if they have shiners in that lake, put more shiners in that lake is what he's saying, I think, right? You know what I mean? Is there, how big a problem? When can you do that? And is there a problem?
I think you get to a point where you can put too many.
Yeah. Yeah, and that makes sense.
If that imbalance happens, then you got another problem.
They screw up something else,
you know. Right? And I'll use the Great Lakes with the sea smelt invasion back in the '50s and sixties.
They were sea smelt.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, you can buy them now at Loblaws.
Yeah.
Smelt.
I just didn't know that's the same thing. They never recall that. Called smelt, right? I thought it were lake smelt or something like that.
No. Huh. Anyways, it got really one-sided, more smelt than predators. Yeah. And next thing you know, we've got an imbalance and they got to put more predators in, which they did. And they successfully they did eradicate smelt with that. So it's, and now there's no food. And now the predators that we put in, there's not enough food for them. So, yeah.
So
now we
got
to reduce the predator count in order to.
Question for you. Yeah. That sea smelt, is that the same species is up in, let's say, Rainy Lake, and because they have smelt in those lakes way up there. Is that the same one?
Yeah.
Really?
Eh? Yeah, it's native to the ocean. All of that is all
cool.
At one point in the evolutionary chain, it was out here and it ended up over there.
And it survives no problem in fresh water, and there you go. Yeah. Okay. Right.
Same as the Atlantic salmon. I hate to bring it up again, but I'll bring it up again.
Ooh,
that's a saltwater fish that ended up converting to freshwater in the Great Lakes, and then we eradicated that. And anyways, why are you getting me started in that?
You know how I feel about it. I said you didn't smelt so good.
I love smelt. Oh. When was the last time you had a good feed of smelt?
Oh, God, when I was a kid, for sure. You know what I mean?
Like, do you remember how
fresh caught? Like, I mean, it's different than you get them frozen. They're still good, but those fresh caught ones, where you stick the scissors up the butt and
cut
them up there, and just and the heads on it. They just fling it in the pan and bread with flour. We used to do just flour, right?
I think that was it. And then when it's all done, you got a plate of them. They're crusty and the fins and everything.
And you
squeeze a lemon on it. Oh my God! And about a pound of salt.
How many people are listening that actually have experienced that compared? I mean, that shows our age for sure. Because I don't know when the last time that happened, but it was good. And the amount of smelts in Lake Ontario, for instance, and the Bay of Quinte, we used to do it there too, was incredible. When they came in the shorelines, we used to just, oh my God, when the nights were good, two scoops, you're done. Two scoops of raisins, and you're done. It was unreal. So,
speaking of eating, you'll notice on fishingcanada.com, we often highlight and feature some of the other podcasters that are on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network.
Come on now.
This week, we're highlighting Eating Wild with Antonio and the boys, Louie and Daniel. They had a guest on that his name is Chef Craig Baxter. And interesting podcast for no other reason. If you are concerned about the ever-rising costs of living in this part of the world, groceries have got to be at the top of that list. Well, this podcast is all about asking the question, are you getting ripped off?
Should be an easy one to find. Just look that up. You're gonna say, and it's such a strong subject right now. I mean, let's be honest. When you go to the grocery store now, compared to even 5 years ago, this is insane.
I'll be honest. I haven't been keeping an eye on that as much as I should have. And I do grocery shopping for our household. Right. Well, I split it in terms of time spent in the grocery store, but I never really looked at
it. Never looked at the price from before.
But I got to tell you, lately, I've been looking, and I say, oh my God. Oh my God. Like
stupid stuff.
A little watermelon is now $10.
Yeah. Yeah.
That used to be $1.99.
Exactly.
Last time I looked.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, and it's on everything. It's on everything. Produce to meats to you name it. It's just cereal, anything. It's horrible.
Yeah.
We are getting ripped off. Check out the podcast, episode 33, Eating Wild.
In the news on fishingcanada.com, a wonderful article. It's up now. It's titled, How Short Will Our Ice Fishing Season Get? And we were talking about that before we started the podcast. In some cases, zero.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people fishing out of boats right now where normally they would be out ice fishing in huts like this one that's sinking.
Yeah, a great picture. Look at that.
It's a great question. You know, how short will it be? I guess there are some ice fishing conditions that are questionable, but still allowing people to go out on them. And I'm talking about the southern part of this country. I know up north they've got,
Lots
2 feet of ice. They're driving tractor trailers on winter roads on the ice. So this applies mostly to the southern part of Canada, in particular Ontario.
Yeah, for sure. As soon as you start getting those plus degrees, you know what I mean? Through January and February, there really shouldn't be any plus degrees. Well, my God, this winter in particular, it's way more plus than it is negative in the daytime. Nighttime just getting down. But even nights, you know, -2 is not good for ice.
No.
You know what I mean? You need -10,
not as far as I'm
really
concerned. I know there are people who argue that. I know that there are people. I know that Dean, you and Steve were out on ice that was questionable last week. I know that. I know you
do. How questionable was it, Deanie?
It was good. It was like
4 inches, I was told.
4 inches, maybe 4.5.
I told my wife that's a lot of ice.
Yeah, I know you do. Yeah,
I think that's a ton of ice.
Yeah. It's questionable. But anyways, regardless, in southern Canada and northern U.S., like the state of Minnesota, for example, you've got to be really careful this year. It's not something that you want to muck around with. There's a wonderful story on the news in fishingcanada.com that will.
I got a question for you guys, and I thought about it this week, because as Dean and Steve were fishing ice, I was less than 30 kilometers away in a boat.
Open water.
Open water in a boat. It was good conditions, so I'll just tell you my conditions. The water was almost dead flat, but it was 34 degrees Fahrenheit. Would you feel safer in that if you were going to do one of them, in the boat where I was or on that ice where Dean was? What do you think?
Oh, 100% in the boat.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, I thought about it.
Wind. Because you know why? See, these gentlemen were to think differently, and this probably has an age thing to do with that. They were too far away from shore. Had something happened out there, which we hear about, and I used to report on a weekly basis, by the way, they're too far from shore to survive it. They're going in. Now.
We were too, if we lost the boat.
But how are you going to lose the boat?
Yeah, I know. I don't know if the boat had float. It wasn't my boat. I'm sure the boat had flotation in it. You know.
But how are you going to lose it? You've got to have, the conditions have got to change.
Right.
They're not going to change that quick, drastic, that you don't have an opportunity to hightail it back to shore.
Well, the boat, you mean? Yeah. If something happened to the boat, you could still stay with the boat, try your best to stay with the boat, 911 with your phone, because one of us, we all set it up proper. We had flotation suits on, we had cell phones ready to go. We even I had a floater suit on, and I had an inflatable life jacket on. You know what I mean? Yeah. So not that it's going to save you from hypothermia, but it could save you. It could help a little bit.
In a lot of cases, what happens on this thin ice is that people overnight, or they have a nap. out there. Next thing you know,
mm-hmm.
shit happens. Like
yeah.
in their case, they had a startling kaboom in the middle of the night.
Like a pressure crack sort of thing?
Pressure crack that scared the hell out of them.
You didn't stay overnight there, did you?
No, no. And oh. it only scared Steve, by the way.
Oh, it didn't. Oh, because you're the tough guy. I yes. see. He's that's it. He's,
well, Stevie doesn't ice fish much, so he's never experienced something like that. Yeah. Probably, you know what I mean. So yeah. Dean's done that his whole life. So a pressure yeah. when you hear it, it does. You know, it opens your eyes.
Sound like a gunshot. It
yeah.
was a good one.
Yeah, it was a good one. was the surface ice frozen or was it melting? Because it was nice out where we
it
were.
Was frozen.
It was only, yeah, it was only plus yeah. two for where we were, so it doesn't really melt too fast no. at that plus yeah. two. But
four inches of ice. If you are anything more than a few hundred yards offshore, you got to worry about it because it's 4 inches where you are right here. But you don't know on a body of water what the conditions are 50 feet away from
correct.
It. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 4 inches bud. Is not enough for anybody to feel secure to go out beyond that distance because things could be happening between you and shore. While you're on 4 inches, all of a sudden there's a 1 inch piece over here that mm-hmm. is now becoming nothing. Mm-hmm. Once that breaks away, and everything moves. You
carried a spud with you, right?
Yeah,
you check out your spud and everything. Yeah. So that's one thing you should anyways. Always do is carry that spud with you on an iffy ice. If it's 12 inches, spud ain't gonna do you any good. And you need it. So
you mentioned flotation in the boat. More important, although you need to wear flotation on a boat. There's no doubt about it. But
as important,
you need
for
it,
sure.
probably more important yeah. in where you were.
Yeah, right? I had it on.
Yeah, yeah these cool. suits that we were wearing are designed for ice fishing.
By the way.
Ice fishing suits, but I bought it because I want it for open water like this time of year too, right? You know what I mean? It's not rated for 9 hours like the Mustangs are, but it's rated for 2 hours and they're warm and comfortable, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why we wear them. What were you going to say, by the way?
Here's a shocker. I think it's great, by the way. Don't take it wrong. I just found out this morning, because we have to submit commercials before we can send commercials to the network. We have to submit them to CRTC.
Yes, our friends at CRTC.
They have the approval yes. of all commercials. We just sent a commercial in, and for the first time in about 10, 15 years,
rejected.
We had a commercial that was rejected today, this morning. And you know
what
why?
The hell?
You know why? Oh, Dean's not even listening to me.
He's writing
too
down.
Busy writing,
he's
down shit. Over there. I got to get him.
He's doing his job.
He's got we need to get him on camera.
It reminded me that I have a commercial thing to do after this, so I put it on my list.
See, so. That's the difference between him and I. We'd be going, huh? What commercial, Lance? What did we do wrong? It's you and I. We get all on a tangent, gone there, and all of a sudden, oh, what who had to do that job? I don't know.
So interestingly, now, I don't know how long it's been going on, maybe forever for all I know.
This is very interesting to me.
CRTC now mm-hmm. is monitoring safety issues on commercials. Before it was content. It was, you know, they have certain guidelines that you can't go down that road. You can't go down that road. They refused a commercial that we submitted because there was a second and a half at the very beginning of the commercial where it was a water scene depicted, people in boats, mm-hmm. and there was a child with no life jacket on.
Wow.
Oh, my.
Well, that was a good
is
catch.
That a shock? I mean, it's good. I love it.
It's a yeah. good catch.
I think it's
them.
Great. I just didn't know that they were that. In this country, we are that regulated.
And they'd have to have somebody there who knows what they're talking about in that sense.
In that
right?
sense,
like
yeah.
who knows that's illegal and knows,
because
you wouldn't think this CRTC would have people who are aware of that.
And it's specific to children because I look, obviously when I got notified of it, I looked at what it was.
The commercial. Yeah.
It's a scene with a child, clearly under 10 years old, and an adult. The adult had no jacket on and that would be okay, mm-hmm. but the child must have a jacket on. Even though there is no law in this country that says you must have.
Oh, really?
That I'm aware of.
I was going to ask that question because I agree with Ange. I don't think there is a law
no.
for a set age.
No.
As long
no.
as, I mean, it's just common sense.
You have to have it on board,
yes.
but you don't have to have it on, which is ludicrous, by the way. Just so
especially
I clarify.
For a kid.
I've been advocating for
everybody.
Better part of two decades that DFO or whoever's in charge of that part needs to mandate life jackets. That would solve so many problems. It would fix so many things that are broken. But don't get me off on that tangent. But CRTC now
wow. That's not our. Did we create the commercial, or is that one somebody's created?
It was
for
sent
us,
to right? us. Okay. I don't want to name the brand because now on the other hand, they don't know it's a U.S. company.
Well, we need to inform them too.
Well, of course we're going to inform them, but I just found that interesting.
That is really interesting. They caught it. They're doing their jobs. So right? somebody caught it.
So you cannot depict the scene according to the CRTC on a commercial. They haven't hit programming yet with that, obviously, because I've seen a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
you know, out in boats with no life jackets on shows, not ours, thankfully. But on commercials, they're saying no. That child, even though it's not the law, that child has to have a jacket on. I applaud them. For the first time you're hearing this live here on Outdoor Journal Radio, the podcast, I'm applauding CRTC.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
There you go.
Wow. Good for them. They're keeping up on it. Yeah. Right?
All right. We've spent way too much time there. We get, every once in a while, we just get bogged down. It's like a mud bowl.
I think it's so organic that I think the audience likes it. Maybe the audience should let us know. If they don't, if we could take off on these tangents and you're saying, well, just get on with the show, idiots, then tell us, please. But if you like this, you know, like that was just very a flow of thin ice to this, to that, to that.
By the way, that scene you see here, if you read the article on fishingcanada.com that's up in the news right now, you'll get a better understanding of how bad it is out there during these conditions.
Yeah.
Check it out.
It's important to know. So. Right.
Fan question of the week, Mr. Bowman.
Yes, sir. This one is submitted by Richard Francoeur. I'm going to say this. Francoeur? Does that sound right to you?
Francoeur. Sounds good.
From Northwest Territories. NWT.
That might be a first.
Nice.
Can we have some kind of...
That's definitely the first. I've never seen it.
Can we hit a button? Hit something.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hit.
That's a hell yeah for Richard. Come on, right there. Nice, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
You got three little sound bites there, buddy.
From Northwest Territory.
Via email. And Richard, he submitted it email. We can do email or on our socials, Fishing Canada, or Facebook or Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. So, Richard's question. Have you ever gotten tired / burnt out of fishing?
Whoa.
Tired
okay.
Or burnt out of fishing.
Do you want me to go first on that?
Sure.
I know my response will probably be a lot different than yours. The answer for me is absolutely. and I would say that's more so in the last 10 to 15 years. Obviously, in my younger days, no. I was an idiot back then and I ignored all the rest of the wonderful things that life has to offer just to be on the business end of a fishing rod. But as I got older, I realized that you can still enjoy it to the max. In fact, you can enjoy it even more when you share those experiences with other things in life. For me, when I come out of the bush after 4 or 5 months of shooting and taping the show, 6 months, some years, I don't want to go anywhere near it for a couple of months. In fact, I want to do the opposite. I want to immerse myself in all of the urbanite activities that I possibly can that I missed while I was in the boonies using an outhouse on a regular basis. So
it all boils down to the shitter, doesn't it?
I wrap myself in porcelain for the next 6 months.
Oh my God.
And enjoy all the wonderful things that normal folks do. He, on the other hand, is not normal. And now we'll listen to his answer to this question.
That didn't burn you out.
Yeah.
You're just tired of it. I guess that makes it
for a period of time.
Of
I'm burned out. I don't want to see another boat and fish or rain or wind or any of that stuff. I don't want to see any of that stuff.
I hear you. Myself definitely the totally opposite of Ange on that one, in that I don't even remember very often if I've ever been burnt out. Just saying, that's enough. And I mean, there's close to it and all that stuff. But we get on Fishing Canada shoots, for instance. We're into 3 days of tough fishing. It's almost like I got to defeat these fish. I got to get, you know, Then and there's many times where I'll come home from a shoot and go on the weekend, go fishing again on the weekend. You know what I mean? So something like that. So I honestly think about fishing every day of my life. There's not a day that goes by when I'm not half that day has got fishing of some sort going through my head from whatever it is. So I can't say as I'm never going to get tired of it for sure. I don't think I will anyways. And burnout from it, it'd have to be pretty extreme for me to get burnout from fishing, I think.
Now, there's two totally different opinions on the same question, same subject.
Yeah.
Don't know if that's what you were looking for in the when you asked that question. I had it like
Ann's had it earlier in life, and he just decided, hey, there's more to this. There's more to life than just the fishing, right? So I just carried it on. That's where we were the same at one time, and then we kind of.
I love, you know, and I'll use, maybe this is a bad example, but maybe I'll use it as an example to maybe drive this point home. So I also love scuba diving, for example, and so does Pete.
Absolutely.
But Pete would rather fish than go scuba diving. With me, I would rather do both, a little bit of both, to get me in that high that people are always looking for when you're doing activities like that. But I want to equate this to vacationing. You know, it's like somebody who goes on vacation that just wants to go to do that one thing. Mm-hmm. Whether it's lying on the beach, whether it's climbing a rock cliff and diving into the ocean, whether it's deep sea fishing, whether it's scuba diving.
Sitting at the pool bar.
So here's the example I want to give you. So Pete and I go to the same resort to vacation. I want to do everything. I want to do it all. I want to do a little bit of everything. Pete would prefer, if fishing was the thing to do, he would fish the whole time we're there.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Nothing wrong with either one. Just that we have different. I love fast cars. I want to sit behind the wheel of a fast car and do shit, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that just as much as I do fishing.
Yeah.
So to be able to do both, to me is
It's a good point.
Me personally is the best thing I could do. With him, he's on the road 7 days shooting the Fishing Canada show under some. By the way. Just to make something perfectly clear, most shoots that we go on have an element of stress element of long days and grueling conditions.
The element of elements.
I could give you all of those things, along with obviously a lot of good stuff. But when he's finished with 7 days of those, I ask him. So what? You know, we come home. I said, so what are we doing? What are you doing this weekend? Oh, I'm going fishing with my buddy. You're going to. And I look at him and say, are you out of your friggin' mind after what we just went through? But that's who he is, right?
Yeah.
Anyways, I would throw that last piece in there.
That's good. I think we covered it. I think we got Richard's question covered. Be the same in Canada.
Hi, everybody. It's Toronto Sportsman Show time, and the entire Fishing Canada Outdoor Journal podcast crew is going to be there.
That's right. We'll be in-house hosting live podcasts, interacting with listeners, and fielding questions from you, our audience, all weekend long.
You can get 15% off your admission price by purchasing through the link on fishingcanada.com.
Spend a weekend with us at Canada's premier event for outdoor enthusiasts, the Toronto Sportsman Show.
Now, I'm saying. The humble goldfish, everyone's favorite aquatic pet. It's small, easy to care for. What's there not to love?
Even the cat may be mesmerized by the color and movements of your aquarium friends. Goldfish are great at home, but don't let them loose.
Releasing goldfish or other domestic aquatic pets or plants into natural environments is harmful to both your pet and the planet.
Goldfish disrupt ecosystems by outcompeting native species for food and resources in degraded habitats. They contribute to algae blooms, they kill aquatic wildlife, and pass viruses and diseases contracted in aquariums to wild fish.
They could even live up to 40 years and grow as big as a football. Anglers, this is where you come in. If you find a goldfish at your local fishing spot, report it to the invading species hotline or go online to eddmaps.com.
Remember to never dump your live bait into the water and risk spreading other aquatic invaders. Keep our lakes free from invaders and don't let them loose.
Mm-hmm.
these mountainsides that are just red, and ultimately they're kind of a bomb waiting to go off. Like it's a little nerve-wracking as a firefighter driving through some of these areas, and you just see, you know, like what looks like could be an inferno.
This week on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast, Networks, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. We discuss one of the fastest growing threats to lodge owners, northern businesses, and humanity as a whole. Wildfire. Well, here to discuss this with us is a forest firefighter, a young unsung hero who for a decade has been putting himself between these raging beasts and your community, Mackenzie Rosen. On this show, we look through the smoke and into the life of a BC forest firefighter. We talk about the science of forest fires and the skill and training required to fight them. So if you're interested in great stories, outstanding people, cool jobs, and fire, feel the excitement and get ready to look through the flames on this one. You never know what we might find on the other side. Find Diaries of a Lodge Owner now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, let's get to the meat potatoes of this whole show. So joining us now is our special guest, Steve Côté. He is the PhD from Sherbrooke University and professor of Department of Biology in Université Laval. Welcome nice. To the show, Steve.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve.
So this is a topic that we've talked about on the program several times. Moose, as you may or may not know, has been under the microscope, certainly in this province of Ontario, for a few years now. And there's all kinds of, you know, reasons given as to why the population may or may not be in decline, maybe may or may not be in a rebuild mode, may or may not be, you know, in harm's way. But the bottom line is we've all seen it. We've seen moose coming, especially in the wintertime, coming out on the roads, to whether it's a salt lick or whatever reasons, mm-hmm. but they're covered in these big patches, and for the most part, I believe they're ticks.
They look mangy. It almost looks like, what's wrong with this thing? There's something wrong, right? So,
and you've done a study, which is great because you're the first person who can actually intelligently tell us what we're looking at when we see these moose that are obviously infected with something. So I'll turn it over to you, my friend.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is definitely winter ticks. And when they are on moose, we only see them in the winter, not because they're not there at other times of year. It's because they're too small to see before that. So the way it works is that's a very special tick. There are several species of ticks in the country, but the one that goes on moose, the winter tick, is very special because it's a one host tick. So that means it doesn't have to go on another host for part of its life cycle. It's only on moose. And the other important thing to know is that they're not on moose year round. They're on moose only from about September at the earliest, most of the time October until April.
And where are they otherwise? Where they must live on another host, don't they?
Plants or something? No,
they don't. Oh. They don't. So in a nutshell, what the life cycle is when you see a moose, what we call a ghost moose, like with these big patches of lost air in the winter, mm-hmm. it's because it's infected with adult ticks, and the adult ticks have taken blood meals that are interfering with a lot of different things in the condition of moose. But it's one of the effect is causing air loss. But these ticks will fall on the ground. Like especially the females by that time are quite big. They're about the size of the nail of your thumb.
Wow.
Then they will drop on the ground in late April, early May. And that's when the moose is free of ticks. And then what happens is the females will lay their eggs there on the litter on the ground. And then the eggs will hatch later in the summer, normally by mid-late summer. And they will become what we call larvae. And the larvae will just do their own things in the vegetation, in the litter. And then when comes about September, they will start to quest. So that means they will look for high vegetation, and then they will just go up the vegetation about 2 to 3 feet high. And then they will just hang out there until something passes and they could grab onto it.
That is insane. That is insane. Steve, where do they fall? You said they fall down to the ground. Where do they fall from at that stage? Are they in trees and plants? Where are they?
From the moose.
No, they're on the moose. They're on the back of the moose in spring. Okay. And then the female jumped on the ground. Okay.
So the entire life cycle of this, by the way, what's the tick called?
Called Dermacentor albopictus. So winter tick is the right.
Winter tick. So its life cycle is spent either on the ground or in a moose.
That's correct.
Not a deer, not a groundhog.
No, it could be. So when they're on the vegetation in September, October, they grab to anything that will pass by. It could be you. It could be a deer. It could be a dog. It could be a moose. And then what happens is the larva is quite small and it's hard to see. And it's just on the moose or on any animal. And then it will start at some point in late fall to start to eat blood. And then they will transform from larvae to nymphs. And then they will be still very small and not very itchy. But most animals are pretty good at grooming. They have what we call program grooming. So they would remove the ticks. Like if it's a deer, the deer are pretty good at grooming. They will remove most of the ticks.
Wow.
And then the nymphs will take another blood meal. Normally they do that by late January or February. And then they become adults. And that's when the problem starts because the adults are much bigger. They take much bigger blood meals. And then it becomes very itchy. And that's when the moose starts to rub on trees, try to get rid of the ticks. But it's most of the time it's too late because they haven't taken care of the ticks before like deer or elk will do. And then sometimes there are just too many. Like they could be... Right. 50, 60, 70,000 of those things on the moose at the time, if it's a region where the infestation rate is quite high. And for some animals, like the calves, for instance, if they have 75,000 winter ticks on them, it could pump up like 3/4 of their blood volume when they feed in the spring. So it's not just the itching and the air loss. They also... lose condition, they stop feeding because they're busy trying to get rid of the ticks and they become very weak. And that's why we see winter mortality in very, very late winter, early spring. And at that time, they just can't take it anymore. And then they basically die of exhaustion and starvation. And normally it's quite synchronized. Like here in Quebec, for instance, most of the moose will die within about 10 days.
10 days? All of them within that period? Yeah,
all of those that are about to die. And obviously the calves are a lot more vulnerable than adults. The adults have a lot of ticks, but they can normally survive better. They would lose condition. It may reduce their reproduction for adult females. They may produce only one calf instead of two or not reproduce at all. But they have a higher chance of survival. But for the calves, in some years, it's really bad. And I guess we'll discuss that later. But it could have high impact on the survival rate.
Is there, Stephen, is there any scientific, you guys have come up with the reason why the moose are not as good groomers as a deer or an elk? Or do they just not feel the ticks earlier? Or is there a reasoning for that? Why the moose? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a really good question. They're like that for any ectoparasites. Like the moose don't have program grooming, probably because they're so big and they haven't evolved with a tons of ectoparasites to deal with. But they're really bad at grooming. Like we don't really know why, but we know that's definitely what they do. Like they started to take care of the ticks when it's too late.
Right.
And you're calling this a programmed grooming. So meaning that it's programmed in the animal that it must.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's part of their genetics. It's part of, it's a behavior like any other behavior that's been selected, and that it's part of the behavioral repertoire of yeah. of the
it's
animal.
Like a dog, like dogs. You don't have dogs, but dogs, when they get fleas, they dig in with their teeth. They just, you see them doing that. Yeah. That's gotta be the same idea as that. I got to get rid of whatever that is. Right. So that's,
Well, the deer do that all the time. Like, you see them biting all over their body. They're scratching and taking small bites, just like you described with the dogs. So they're much better at it than the moose.
Is this something that we're just noticing now? I mean, when I say now, I mean, I've been doing, I would say it's been 10 years that I've been talking about moose and this tick. Where was it beforehand, or did we just not know about it? We just thought, well, that's a sick looking moose, and oh, it died, you know, we're not really knowing.
No, it's been around for a while. There were well, in Canada, most of the pioneering work was done by Bill Samuel in Alberta as far back as in the 70s. And he did quite a bit of work there on winter ticks, and so we've known them for a while. They've been around for much longer than that. But in the eastern part of the country, in Ontario, but especially in Quebec, they were not very common before, because that's also dependent on the winter.
That's what I was going to ask you. You know, as our climate obviously changes, and we're
this
in
winter
that,
in particular.
This winter is a good example. At least here it is. Anyways, does that give a whole new opportunity to these ticks? Do you think they're going to expand with warmer weather?
Yeah, that's what we're seeing now. Like, we've started to see the first cases of mortality in Quebec in about 2002, and the prevalence, so the number of animals with ticks, have also increased steadily since then. And we didn't have that before, or not to that level, because a lot of the ticks, when they were dropping from the moose in late April, they would just drop on the snow and they would just die there. And that would be the end of it. Same in the fall, like early snow in the fall will be negative for the survival of the larva, and they will not be able to quest, so that find a host, and a lot of them will die. So to get rid of the ticks, we want as much a late spring as possible and as much as an early winter as possible. But now these things are changing, and we get early springs more and more often, and we get late onset of winter also more and more often, so that the conditions are good in the fall for the ticks, and the conditions are good in the spring for the females to lay their eggs, and their eggs also to survive better. Wow. And throughout that time, the ticks, it's all a bit like an arm race. The ticks are also developing better ways to infect their hosts.
Right.
So they also survive better in the summer. And we're conducting a bunch of experiments now. I have a PhD student working on that, try to see how they survive as larvae in the litter. And we have an experiment right now in the bush seeing if they could survive a winter, because everybody always said they cannot survive a winter if they're not on a host. But I'm questioning that now. Wow. It might still be the case, but they may be able, and even in some regions, to survive that. So all this climate change, in conjunction with another very important factor, that is the moose density, like to have epizootics that will cause mortality, you need both a winter tick population that is doing well, but you also need a population of hosts that is doing well. And in Quebec, the last 15-20 years, we had very high moose density, especially in the southern part of the province, much higher than we used to have in the 70s and 80s when I grew up. We didn't have these densities of moose. Now it's has started to decrease, like in Ontario. And the good years of high density of moose are behind. Like the next decade is not going to be as good as what we were used to in the last, two decades now that it's been good.
Wow.
So if you have high density of moose and good climate conditions, you're looking at the risk of having a epizootic with quite negative effects of winter ticks.
Do you ever find a deer, dead deer from the winter ticks? Is it a bad thing with deer at all, or is it just mostly moose?
It's mostly moose because the deer have ticks, but they groom them. So they don't build high numbers.
Okay.
So if you have only like a handful of ticks, big, but that's not going to be a big effect on the animal. But when you have thousands of them, that's when the impact gets higher.
Steve, they're not transferring anything into the animal then. These ticks are unlike some other ticks where they will transfer solutions into the animal in order to make the area numb so that the animal doesn't feel them there. Like they're just pretty primitive in this sense. They just grab on. They eat when they want to eat. They're not really evolved to the point where they could trick the animal to not even knowing that it's on there.
No, they really know they're there. It's just that obviously all blood eating animals, they when they feed, they will inject an anticoagulant in there that is in the saliva so that the blood keeps coming through. Yeah. But other than that, no, they're just doing their things.
And they're not harmful. They're not harmful other than the transferring of blood out of the animal. There's nothing else that they're putting into the animal, such as bacteria and that type of thing that might kill it, which might also transfer maybe to humans that are consuming the animal. That's what I'm getting at. So there's nothing for moose hunters to worry about if they shoot an animal and it has a lot of ticks on it. They can still harvest the animal just like they would any other moose.
Yep.
So there's no worries.
That's fine for
that's
that.
That's a good point. That's a great point.
Well, you know, sometimes you look at that,
you say,
I'm not eating that.
I'll call the ministry and say, see you later. Right. What about, these are not Lyme disease types of ticks, correct?
No. So there's two things with that. Like Lyme disease, it's transmitted by another species of ticks that we call blackleg ticks. There's no evidence of any disease or bacteria or anything in the winter ticks. Doesn't mean that it will always be like that. It could happen one day. Like Lyme disease has not always been in black-legged ticks and in deer and mouse and mice and all these. So, but for now, there's nothing negative for humans or for the moose in winter ticks, except that they just take blood. And so that's all fine with that. Don't forget that when a hunter harvests a moose, most of the moose would be harvested in October, where the moose has no ticks or just very tiny larvae.
Right.
Sorry, this is my phone.
No, that's
very very small larvae that you cannot really see. Most hunters will not notice them.
Right.
And when they skin the animals, they remove the skin. It's just gone, and the meat is perfectly fine.
And there's no chance of that tick transferring to a human, right?
No, it could go on a human, but you will see it, and you will just remove it as any other ticks.
Wow.
I wonder how many ticks you and I have actually had.
You know,
I mean, we've been in the bush so many years. I mean, Dean's had them. Mikey Burris gets them every year, but it's the stuff we do. We don't hunt, but...
I thought about this morning as I was going through my head that we were going to be doing this program with Steve. You know what I thought of? I thought of all those years that we spent in the bush, in the jungle, in the...
Oh, my God.
The gnarliest... areas on the planet.
From the Northwest Territories.
Have we ever checked ourselves? I don't think we have.
No.
We've never really looked. Eh?
No.
We got lucky. We felt very lucky. But.
Yeah, absolutely.
We interrupt this program to bring you the much-anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is MOOSE. That's MOOSE, all in capitals, MOOSE. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all our current giveaways. For those who haven't entered yet, what the heck are you waiting for? Head on over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the show.
Absolutely.
This study that you're conducting, I'm assuming there's a reason. Not what I mean by that is, are you looking for a way of eradicating this thing at some point? Are you looking for maybe a deterrent that the moose can I don't know, ingest? Are you looking, like, what are you doing with the study? What's, I mean, we see, and the reason I say that, we see what's happening. It's very visual. We see these animals infested. What's the point of the study?
Yeah, right now, the study we're doing is really to better understand the winter ticks and the impact it has on the eastern moose. So that's the main goal. Obviously, we want to come up with recommendations of what would be good or not good to decrease the risk of having really high, like years with very high winter tick infestations. We're not at a point where we want to treat moose for like every single moose in the forest, because that's just not feasible. Okay. So what we've been doing is we started a collaring program with GPS collars, as quite a few folks do. Yeah. And we've done that in five different studies areas spread in, from southern New Brunswick to different areas in the whole province of Quebec. And every other moose that we catch, we treat it with an ectoparasite. So we'll call it with a, it's an anti anacaricide that will remove the ectoparasites. So we give him a bolus that he injects when we handle the animal, and we also spray the product on its back. And what happens with that is it greatly reduces the number of ticks the animal has, but all the rest remains unchanged. Like, the animals are in the same habitat. They just right. do their own things.
Right.
We do that in every region, every other moose. So we can isolate the impacts of ticks. So when we look at survival, we know that the moose are all the same. The only difference is we remove the ticks from that one.
Yep.
And then when we look at habitat selection, when we look at all sorts of different parameters, the only thing that change is the ticks. So that we can really understand what is the role of ticks. And to give you a very concrete example, like here we have a study area just 20 kilometers from my office in Quebec City. So just outside Quebec City. And last year, every calf that we caught, we normally catch them in January when the ticks are on. And we look at the survival from January to April. So only 4 months, like basically the heart of the winter. And every single calf that we caught and treated survived the winter, and all those that we did not treat but one died over that winter.
Wow.
So that wow. don't that's... have to be a big rocket scientist with complex stats to understand that's an extreme year. Normally it's not as bad as that. Normally we'll look at like 40% mortality rate, but in some years it's bad. Like in Maine last year, they collared over 100 calves, and the mortality rate from January to April was 86%. So you wipe out almost an entire cohort.
Yeah.
Is it possible, though, and we just did a podcast recently with some scientists regarding the handling of certain fish species after they're originally caught, and a lot of things came up in that podcast, you know, because sometimes we focus on the obvious and don't see other contributing factors. First thing I'm thinking about as you're talking, is it possible that the moose that you collared, obviously they were stressed, traumatized. They went through this whole procedure of being caught in the first place and then handled, and then a collar's placed on them, and then off you go. Is it possible that any of that would have contributed to the mortality rate, because the animal was maybe already weak with the tick problem, and then by doing this, we kind of contributed to it?
Yeah, no, as I said, we do that to every other moose we catch. So that means that we treat one, the next one we don't treat it. We treat one, the next one we don't treat it.
But you don't see the non-treated animal, you don't see anymore.
We do, because we put a collar on and we follow exactly the same way as the other one. So all those that were treated and had a collar survived. So they went through the same procedure as the other one.
Yeah,
same
you're stress, comparing the same apples handling, to apples then. Yeah,
same
yeah.
everything.
Okay.
So that's...
Yeah.
That's the power of this experiment, is it's actually an experiment. So we control for all the factors except the one we want to infer on, which is the impact of winter ticks. All and the rest is the same.
Is it possible that we could take this? I'm assuming you put a chemical or something to get rid of the tick or powder, whatever form it's in. Is it possible that this could be used as a means of getting rid of the tick before it gets on the host? In other words, when it's on the ground.
Spray the area with the airplane spraying or something.
Yeah. Is it possible that that might happen?
No. Well, a lot of people think about that, especially to put it on salt blocks.
Yeah.
But the problem is when they use the salt block in the spring, they don't have tick on. And the ticks will only come in October where they're interested in other things than salt. Like they may go at salt blocks, but they're mainly looking for mate and they're not into salt anymore. So, and you need quite a high dose to this to be effective. So, so that's not easy. And if you only put it on the back, that's not working. We tried that the first year. We need also to have a bolus ingested.
Oh, wow.
So it's a little more complicated.
So it's if you don't have your hand on the moose, it's complicated and it doesn't last forever. Like animals, like people that are, let's say you have moose in a zoo or a deer or whatever at home. You have to do that like people do with their dogs. Like they will treat them. These products were originally made for dogs or for horses, but they do, or cattle, and they do that like several times a year, so that they get rid of the ticks.
Are you talking? Is it permethrin you're talking about, or is it something like that? It is.
Yeah, permethrin is one of those, and furelaner is the other one. So we use both, but we had to modify the permethrin because that's the first one we use on the back of the moose the first year. But the commercial concentration is too small to have an effect, so we had to increase that.
So Dean's a hunter here, Dean, that's the producer that you talked to, and he looked it up and he found that permethrin was illegal to use that as a Canada or just Ontario?
I think it was a federal thing.
A federal thing. So for us, we can't use it. You're using it obviously as a scientist. Is it illegal to be used in Quebec as well, like across the country?
That's true, yeah.
Okay. Now, what would you think about getting that so we could use it in the country? What's your opinion on that? Should we be using permethrin to an extent?
Well, it's not going to change anything because like all the moose that are in the forest, they're not going to be near human beings for most of their life, except when they're hunted.
Right.
So there's no real practical way. Like the way we're going with that is really to understand the impact of ticks. Like right now, we know they have a really big impact on mortality of calves. And now we need to move on. That's what we're doing right now. Like we're looking at habitat selection of ticks and habitat selection of moose. And we try to determine where are the most risky spots for the moose to hang out. And what are the type of forests or forest management that will be positive for the ticks and negative for the ticks. And our hope is to be able to come up with recommendations about forestry treatments that we won't get rid of the ticks, but that will be decreasing the number of ticks, or at least not enhancing their survival of being favorable to them, and try to manage the forest that way so that we can at least reduce the number of ticks that are picked up by moose.
So let's say we're not worried about spreading the whole world of permethrin. What about for usage on a hunter and on an angler? If it was legalized in our clothing, if we could spray it on our clothing to help us for deer ticks and for Lyme disease.
Pushing him to give you the answer
you're
looking for.
Well, I just want to know his opinion. No, he could say that's terrible, it's good or whatever. I'm just wondering.
From a health standpoint.
If we just got a little bit of infusion, maybe you buy clothing with it in there.
He wants your buy-in, Steve. He's looking for your buy-in. We want to use the stuff.
Do you believe in that stuff? Should we? Exactly, Steve. You and I and Ange will get a clothing line going here pretty soon. Don't you worry after this. What do you think?
That's the first time I hear that one, to be honest, because normally for humans, it's just on your clothes, so you just.
Right.
Yeah,
but that's what we're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
Remove them from your clothes. So that's.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And you don't, normally you don't pick a lot. Like I do, I hunt moose every year, I hunt deer every year. And it's very rare that I would pick some. When I do pick some, or my students pick some, is when we go on cluster of points of moose in the spring And we know these moose were heavily infected when we caught them. And then we go doing flagging, try to estimate the number of ticks in the environment. And some days they don't get any, but sometimes they go in hot spots and they ride in the middle of something, and then their trousers are just covered with winter ticks. Yeah.
Wow. We're thinking more in terms of, we're not even thinking of winter ticks. We're thinking more in terms of deer ticks.
Yeah, black-legged ticks.
Black-legged ticks, right? For the Lyme disease problem. And we heard, and it seems to be effective, that it is probably the only thing that you can put on your clothing that will repel them.
Yeah, right? Repel them and make you feel good about being out there.
But unfortunately, it's not allowed to be sold in Canada. So,
yeah, but I don't think it would work like a regular repellent too, because it's something that's spread very, like it's really greasy, so it needs to emulsify on the animals. So that's very thick when you pour it normally, and it needs time just to go very, very slowly through the hair and on the skin. And if you would do that, you would have it would have to be on your legs to work, and you will have very greasy legs for a while. So I'm not sure.
Okay, this is interesting, and I know we're a little off topic. So if I spray it on my clothing.
If there was a way of getting rid of the oiliness and make it more water, like make it sprayable. Because he's making it sound like it's not sprayable.
I have it in like an aerosol.
It's sprayable.
Yeah.
It's sprayable because they use it on horses in a spray form, right?
Right.
And the concept for us is to spray it on our clothing, especially the lower portion of the body where you're walking through high grasses and stuff. Even if it's got to be sprayed every time out, I think it would, if it's repelling the ticks, which I believe it is, I mean, that's a huge home run as far as I'm concerned for deer ticks I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too, it's with this product, they have to eat it to be affected because that it's acting on their nervous system.
So
it's not like a mosquito repellent that they don't like the smell or anything like that. So if you have it on clothes, they will still have to eat it. And if they're just on your clothes, they will not be taking blood or attaching to you. So I'm not a specialist, of course, of pharmaceutical products, but I have doubts that it would work readily as a spraying on clothes. But
It's interesting. We learned something new.
They sell infused drinks, permethrin infused clothing. So
feel good about that now?
I'm still using it.
Dean didn't say that, by the way, to anybody listening.
It's a fascinating topic. What's the duration of this study? How long are you guys going to be working on this?
Yeah, that study was it's a 5-year study, including 3 years of field work. So we've just wrapped up the field work now. We've put like over almost 350 callers out in five different regions. So that was a really big really big investment. Mm-hmm. And we're working on the analysis right now and writing up the results.
What's the deal with that? If a hunter is out there and he sees a collared moose, is he still allowed to harvest that moose or not?
Yes.
They are allowed.
Yes, we thought about that first in some regions, because most of our main interest for us is between January and April, May.
Ah, okay.
So there's no real concern with harvest, but we leave the collars on until late October because we want to look at habitat selection of moose, especially in early fall, just to try to assess where they go. Where they will pick up ticks, because that's one thing is where they drop them. So the ticks are not going to walk for like hundreds of kilometers. So the ticks, the places where they drop them in the spring should be the most dangerous place to get reinfected to go in the fall. So we're comparing spring habitat selection with winter, with early fall habitat selection. So after that, the collars has a drop off anyway and will drop on the ground. So I don't really care if I get it back in the bush or if a hunter kills it, as long as he's not shooting in my collar, I'm happy with that.
What do these things do in the meantime? Obviously, you've studied it. So what are they doing in the meantime in terms of nourishment? Do they even need nourishment when they drop? Are they're not feeding them? Just not feeding at all. They're just hanging around.
Yeah, well, you mean when after the females lay her eggs?
Well, at some point, these things leave the moose, they drop off, right? And they start their, I'm assuming, their reproduction cycle right away.
The males die.
They die. Okay.
And the females will just hatch, will just lay eggs.
Lay the eggs.
She died.
Okay.
And then the eggs will hatch. A larva will come, and then that's a new generation coming in. So the big females that, like, full of blood and things, after they lay their eggs, they're done. Dead.
So they have one cycle, 1 year for them, one season, and they're done. And then the larva.
Well, that's what we think, unless they can survive as larva under snow for one winter. Mm-hmm. But that would be a breakthrough. We don't know that yet, but that's not impossible, as we used to say, I think.
Okay. Mm. Interesting. It's a fascinating subject, and thank God there's people working on getting solutions, because as outdoors people, sometimes we take it for granted, right? We get up in the morning, grab our hunting gear, fishing gear, get in the truck, pick up your buddy, go out, enjoy a great day. You don't realize how much work and how many people are behind the scenes making sure that we have the resources available to us. And and for that, we thank you, you and your group. And I'm sure that there are similar programs going on in other parts of the country, maybe in North America. And we applaud
Ontario you guys. Is starting a program now. We just met with them in mid-December. And they're starting a program on moose just north of Thunder Bay. That's their plan right now for also the next 5 years. So you're probably going to hear about that in the next few years quite a bit in Ontario.
What about Labrador, Newfoundland? Because apparently there's a high population of moose there. Is there a high population of winter ticks there?
That's a good question. I don't work much in Newfoundland. I don't think it's as important as it is on the continent. But that's a question I don't have the answer to. That's a good one.
I don't think there'd be any ticks in Newfoundland. That's just a wonderful part of the
that's
world.
Right. They won't let them go there.
Exactly. Nothing happens bad there.
So true.
Steve, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate your time. I know you've got a busy schedule, and we appreciate you sharing some of that time with us. And shining the light on this thing that we've been wondering about for years.
Yeah, best of luck in your studies. Thank you for doing
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Steve Côté from Quebec, obviously in Quebec City.
University of Laval.
University of Laval. Thank you very much. Interesting subject matter. Wow. You know, and I'm not kidding you. This morning, as I'm getting ready to come out here, I thought about that. Because we used to pride ourselves in walking through the gnarliest, ugliest, remote parts of the world with shorts on.
Oh, yeah.
with shorts on to boot. We never wore log pants.
Yep. But even as kids, like just walking in the bush, like from childhood to last summer, you know, we just do it all the time, right? So we did it all the time and do it all the time. We're just knock on wood, lucky. We're lucky that we haven't got...
I've got them once, as you know. And it was
and you got all of it.
Recent.
Yeah, and you got and did the whole deal with the pills and all that stuff.
And I got to be honest with you, I don't know whether I would have caught that had it not been for... somebody else, Nick, in this case, getting it and saying, I think I got a tick. Because we never checked.
Oh, God, no.
It was
I'd see that. If I see a little one there, I'd think it was a mosquito bite.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd pick it up, you know, okay, that's a mosquito bite. I got bit by a black fly. Okay. That's what you do.
I swear, though, I at one point in my life, I think I had Lyme disease. I think I've told you.
Yeah.
I went through about 2 or 3 years of hell with that whole thing. But anyways, interesting subject. That are it, my friend. Aside from letting
keeps
folks
your mind
know,
keep going. Your mind just gets going about all these poor deer you see in the or moose and deer, but
seeing
those
moose. Itchy,
it makes you itchy, exactly. And it just looks so gross. And I feel for them when they're rubbing against that tree. And I mean, he wipes out 100, and there's still 2,000 left on them, you know, somewhere else. It's like, oh my God, crazy.
And they must run out of the woods just in sheer desperation.
Yeah. It's got to be.
Help.
I know. Like, imagine a couple thousand bugs biting you and eating your blood. Anyway.
That are it. Don't forget fishingcanada.com, the portal, the gateway to your outdoor adventures awaits you. We are giving away all kinds of goodies there. Make sure you're getting your fair share of them.
That's a good way of putting it.
I see we just sent another Panasonic unit, a scanning unit somewhere in northern Ontario or something. I don't know.
Panasonic.
Panasonic.
I don't know.
What the hell are you talking about? Panoptics? Is that what you're trying to talk about?
Sure, why not? We just sent. Oh, I know what it was. It was an actual trip.
Yes, we did.
The Nordic Point.
Yep.
Nordic Point Lodge.
Obviously, somebody has to win this stuff, folks. It might as well be you because somebody is going to take it home.
Yes. If it takes a little bit of work, think about that, too. Think
what
about
kind of work are we talking
maybe
about?
Maybe you put more than one ballot in. Maybe put two ballots in. Maybe put 200 ballots in.
I can work say from a guy behind the scenes, the people who win usually put a lot of work into
there you go, folks.
Their entrance. So you there just you go. Burst my bubble.
Why? You want
he
people
says
to
anybody
work
can
for their...
Win, right? Antoine says anybody can win.
Anyone can win, but the more
just
effort...
Burst my bubble.
It's a meritocracy. The more effort...
It's a what?
Meritocracy. Based on merit.
You know what that is?
Oh, yeah. Like, look at you, Mr. Napity.
I'm all about merit. I'm based, my whole life is merit.
okay, it's interesting. So the more you put in, definitely, we have the proof. We have the data to prove the more you put in, the better your chance of winning.
Yep.
See?
See?
There you go. We're even totally transparent to you folks. That are it. Thank you for joining us once again on behalf of the entire team. Volva, Nick, Dean, and Peter. I'm Angelo. Thank you, folks. Talk to you soon.